As we prepare for the season of preparation, right? Expectant waiting, the 4 weeks of Advent leading to the 12 days of Christmas, it's appropriate that we find in our lectionary readings stories and metaphors involving childbirth. This morning we find birth as an answer to prayer, birth as the beginning of a new chapter of the Israelite journey of faith. And birth, and more specifically, as Jerry just read for us, birth pangs and the labor necessarily involved in giving birth, as a metaphor reminding us that the journey to new life, shifting from old to new ways of living and being, can be painful. I heard an interview this past Friday on WHYY with Sonora Allwood and Dr. Jillian Lucas Baker, co-creators and co-hosts of what has, in its first season, quickly become a very popular podcast called A Tribe Called Fertility. Maybe you heard the interview, or maybe you're otherwise familiar with the podcast. Their focus is on sharing information and honest conversation about maternal health and experiences around fertility, particularly among Black families, mindful that African American women are 3 times more likely than white women to die of complications from childbirth, and twice as likely as white women to face infertility. Allwood and Lucas Baker are friends who grew up and met as teenagers in the Bronx, both now medical professionals in this area. They discovered a few years ago that they had both previously dealt with infertility, with the shame and stigma that can come with not being able to get pregnant, and in realizing that they could have been each other's support if they had known that about each other, they decided to create this podcast to make that kind of support available for others. At one point, Allwood describes how valuable it would have been for her to have that kind of support. She said, even just having someone to talk to, because it was just so alienating and isolating. And when I would gather up the strength to say something to someone, like I often talk about talking with my mom and my aunties, they would often dismiss it like, girl, ain't nothing wrong with you. Just get on your knees and pray. Now that kind of response is, of course, dismissive and insensitive, and her words speak to the deeply socialized intensity and pressure and often stigma that can come with the experience of infertility, when fertility is so deeply intertwined with a sense of personal identity. That's true now, still, and it was certainly true in ancient Israel, where women's identities were so closely, intimately tied to their ability to produce offspring. Stories, as you may know, stories and themes of infertility and fertility get a lot of play in the Bible on multiple levels, and that's certainly the case with our reading from the opening chapter of 1 Samuel this morning. New life emerging from barrenness. New life emerging literally and figuratively where there had been, or at least seemed to be, no chance. Getting on her knees and praying for fertility, praying that she will get pregnant, is exactly what Hannah does. Hannah, along with Peninnah, one of Elkanah's 2 wives, in verse 2, just before our reading, the line is clearly drawn and the tension clearly established. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now, setting aside any aversion we may have to the notion of multiple wives, we come to find that Peninnah, because she had children, is not only dismissive and insensitive toward Hannah, she's straight up cruel. Cruel. She's described as Hannah's rival in the text, intentionally and consistently provoking and irritating her, year after year lording her own fertility, the fact that she had children, over Hannah's infertility and the fact that she did not and could not have children. It is a tragic tendency of human nature that we can be so cruel and devoid of compassion for each other, operating within oppressive cultural, socio-political, and economic worldviews and structures, consciously or not, jockeying for relative status and privilege within those hierarchical and falsely dichotomous structures, and so, consciously or not, directing our internalized dis-ease with those structures at each other and not at the structures themselves, and those whose power and privilege depends on keeping those structures intact. Injustice, right? Injustice thrives on this short-sighted tendency of human nature. Racism, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia depend on this tendency. And those in political, economic, and religious power have long exploited that tendency. Imagine, just imagine how different this story would be if Penina stood in solidarity and support, stood in the struggle with her sister, right? Her sister rather than against her. Imagine how different the story would be. But back to the actual story. We're not surprised to learn that Hannah wept and would not eat. She's miserable, her misery only compounded by Penina. So she does the only thing she knows to do within her power, her limited power. She prays. As the text puts it, she presents herself before the Lord, understanding as she does that the Lord is the one who has closed her womb in the first place, and so is the only one who can open it. Now, that troubling theological assumption, of course, would require some unpacking, but for now, we need only understand that this is how Hannah sees it, how she sees her own situation. And for now, it's important that we get how fervently she prays. She's desperate, beyond desperate. And so she makes a vow to God. O Lord of hosts, if only you will look on the misery of your servant and remember me, and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a male child, then I will set him before you as a Nazarite until the day of his death. He shall drink neither wine nor intoxicants, and no razor shall touch his head. She vows, in essence, that if God grants her a son, he will belong to God and not to her. She prays silently, but so fervently that we're told her lips were moving. And so Eli, the priest, for whatever reason, assumes she must be drunk. How long will you make a drunken spectacle of yourself? Put away your wine. She responds, no, my Lord, I am a woman deeply troubled. Hear that. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman. Hear that, despair, for I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation all this time. We can hear and feel her fragile identity and sense of self-worth. We can hear and feel her distress, and we are also meant to hear and feel her determination, her faithfulness, her steadfastness. Eli the priest does, and offers her peace and his own prayer that her petition would be granted. We have no idea for how long Hannah had been praying these prayers. We know this has been years ongoing. But at that moment, she is a changed woman. She doesn't know if her petition will be granted, but we're told that her countenance was sad no longer. She seems, as far as we can tell, to have laid down her internal burden, to have released what was out of her control. And of course, as the story goes, her prayers are answered. This barren woman, like Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel before her, like Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist after her, is able to conceive, eventually giving birth to Samuel. Samuel, who you may remember, would go on to play such a pivotal role in the Israelite journey of faith, ushering in the beginning of the Hebrew monarchy. He, Samuel, who would become known for his extraordinary wisdom, a prophet eventually venerated by Jews, by Christians, and by Muslims. And note, nowhere in the story, right, before and beyond our reading, are Peninnah's children ever identified. Hannah is lifted up as yet another example of dogged determination in the long line of faithful servants within the whole arc of Israel's narrative. A woman praying through her profound grief and anxiety, her powerlessness, and in so doing, enabling new life, where new life, by all accounts, after years of hardship and barrenness, did not seem possible. Hannah's labor of love, see what I did there? Right? Hannah's labor of love includes her faithful labor before she conceived, believing against belief, hoping against hope, and her labor of love continues after she gives birth to Samuel, as she does, in fact, follow through on her word to give her son to the Lord. Again, troubling as the thought of turning over a child to the religious or any other establishment may be to our current modern sensibilities, the point here is that Hannah fulfills her vow. She is faithful to the God who she believes has proved faithful to her. As the translation in verse 28 puts it, she gives to God what God has given to her. And in so doing, her personal story finds its place within the larger Hebrew story, and their story continues, and new life once again finds its way out of wilderness. This week's gospel reading concludes what has been a year-long lectionary journey through the Gospel of Mark. A year ago, the first Sunday of Advent began in this same chapter of Mark, and so this morning's reading now brings us full circle. This morning's reading is unmistakably apocalyptic. Apocalypse from the Greek meaning revealing or uncovering. Right, you heard Jerry Reed, for nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. This is but the beginning of the birth pangs. This is but the beginning of the birth pangs. And here we go again with the birth metaphor, the labor of love. Scholars tell us that Mark was likely written during or perhaps just after the Jewish revolt against Roman occupation of Palestine, roughly 66 to 70 CE. The Roman armies had squashed the rebellion and destroyed the Jewish temple. So the overall message of Mark's gospel is one of persistent hope in the midst of very real ruin and despair. As one commentary puts it, to really hear that message, quote, we have to listen from a position of desolation, chaos, and bewilderment. We have to listen alongside the traumatized soldier, the displaced refugee, the activist discouraged by lack of real progress, the heartbroken family. This is where Mark lives. These are the depths from which Mark proclaims good news. And I think it's important for us to understand, too, that apocalyptic literature, as with the biblical books of Daniel and Revelation in the Bible, represent a creative and hopeful response to the harsh reality of community pain and suffering. revealing and uncovering in spectacular, intentionally evocative fashion, an imminent future in which God ushers in a new era, the good news where the world is turned right side up, where suffering ends and justice prevails, where the last are first and the first are last, as Jesus says, where new life emerges out of death and destruction. The temple in Jerusalem was only just being built, actually rebuilt, in Jesus' day. The large stones that his disciples are so impressed by at the start of chapter 13 are estimated to be 35 feet long by 18 feet wide by 12 feet high. To visualize, that's roughly six of me laid out on the floor like this, right? Three of me laid out on the floor like that, and two of me this high. Those are big stones. Coming out of the temple and responding to his disciples, Jesus is clearly intentionally following the prophetic tradition of Jeremiah and Micah in predicting the temple's destruction, suggesting that not one of these stones will be left here upon another. And in so doing, understand that Jesus, who is moving closer to the crucifixion he knows is coming, is preparing his disciples for the work ahead, deliberately framing their current and expected coming struggles as but the beginning of the birth pangs, the necessary labor that will inevitably, albeit painfully, lead to new life and his new way marked by love and liberation. A revolution of values and priorities described so powerfully by Hannah in her song, that's in chapter 2 beyond our reading this morning, chapter 2 of 1 Samuel, and echoed, of course, in Mary's so-called Magnificat, right? Her song upon hearing that the angel Gabriel, and believing what the angel Gabriel says to her, that against all belief, she will become the mother of Jesus. We hear her song every year during Advent, and we'll hear it again in the lectionary in a few weeks. And both Hannah and Mary, both of their glorious visions of the mighty brought down and the lowly lifted up, the world turned right side up. We, all of us are called to join this ongoing labor of love, to do what the midwives tell expectant mothers to do, and what those of you who are biological mothers in the room or on Zoom know what it feels like to give birth, we're reminded to do, which is what? Breathe and push. Breathe and push. Breathe and push and keep breathing and pushing as long as it takes the long, ongoing labor of love and justice. On New Year's Eve 2016, you probably remember that day, right? So this is with a Trump presidency looming. As part of a watch night service hosted by the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, the Sikh activist and author and mother, Valerie Kaur, delivered an incredibly powerful speech, further reframing this work we are called to as people of faith, as people, God's beloved people, grounded in relentless faith and hope, ever leaning toward new life and new ways of living and being. If you haven't seen it before, Google it. I promise you it will lift your spirits, it will make your day. In her speech, she asks rhetorically, what if this darkness, is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? Hear that. What if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What difference would it make, does it make for you to believe deep down inside yourself that the struggles you're facing in your life right now, today, and that the struggles we're facing collectively together as a people and as a planet are but the beginning of the birth pangs, the necessary labor leading us all to deeper love and abundant life. Friends, believing against belief and hoping against hope, as Hannah did, and always, always breathing, then pushing, breathing, and then pushing. May we continue to labor on our own and with each other toward deeper love and life more abundant for all. May it be so.